Testing. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The Mumenkon, Case 32. A non-Buddhist questions the Buddha. A non-Buddhist once asked the world-honored one, "I do not ask for words, nor do I ask for no words." The world-honored one remained seated. The non-Buddhist praised him, saying, "The great compassion of the world-honored one has dispelled the clouds of my ignorance and enabled me to be enlightened." Making a bow of gratitude, he departed. Ananda then asked the Buddha, "What realization did the non-Buddhist have that made him praise you like that?" The world-honored one replied, "He is like a high-mettled horse which starts at even the shadow of the whip." Mumen's commentary. Ananda is Buddha's disciple, yet his understanding falls far short of the non-Buddhist. Now tell me, how different are they, the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumen's poem. He walks along the edge of a sword and runs over the sharp ridges of an ice floe. You need take no steps. Let go your hold on the cliff. Now, as we all well know, for the most part, when the Buddha gave teaching, people gathered around him asking questions, usually using words or gestures. However, in this case, a non-Buddhist asks for a teaching that is bound by neither words nor the wordless. And as noted, the Buddha just sat there. The non-Buddhist had a realization and suddenly broke through his shell. With gratitude, he paid his respects to the Buddha. And as many of you know, Ananda was the Buddha's cousin and primarily responsible for what we now know about the Buddha, because he had what we would call today a photographic memory, and he regurgitated or reiterated everything that the Buddha had to say during a council, and subsequently it was written down. So he was around the Buddha every day, yet he didn't get it. And those of you studying the Threefold Lotus Sutra will recall one of the reasons why he didn't get it. You know, what is that old saying about familiarity? What does it breed?
Contempt.
Contempt, yeah. And he was his cousin, and so he was around him all the time, and he didn't see the aspect of the Buddha that was enlightened. You know, Buddha was his cousin. So it makes sense that Ananda was baffled by what had just happened. Now the question I pose this morning is, how far apart are the non-Buddhists and Ananda in understanding? And this brings me to a collection of the Agama Sutras. And within that sutra, there's one scripture entitled "The Whip's Shadow," where the Buddha talks about four kinds of horses. drawing an analogy to four types of practitioners. And as you well know, before the inventions of cars, people rode horses or horses pulled carts, and people used whips to get the horse to start. Now, the Buddha said that with some horses, no whip is necessary, while with other horses, a whip needs to be used repeatedly. The first type of horse is one that is tame. You just show the whip, and the horse knows what to do. Now, what does this mean in terms of teaching this type of student? Well, it means that he or she only needs a hint to get it immediately. He or she will know what to do without being shown again. So the first horse represents a student who is truly ripe for awakening. With only one hint, the student will realize his or her true nature. And moreover, this person will connect one teaching to others and grasp various concepts in the most profound way. With the second type of horse, the whip is used to brush against its mane and get it going. Students of this type will do only what they are told to do, step by step. If you ask them, "How come when I asked you to do this, you didn't do that as well while you were at it?" And they will answer, "You didn't tell me to." So they're unable to make connections and need to be told what to do. Notwithstanding, when they are told to do something, they do it wholeheartedly. So in this sense, they are honest and steadfast. They are solid practitioners, but they need an extra push to be awakened. The third type of student is when the horse starts moving, but only after being whipped directly on the flesh. Now, this can be compared to students who say, when giving a teaching, "Yes, yeah, I know, I know." With a second teaching, they say, "Yes, I know how to do that." It is only with the third one, that they say, "Okay, I'll do it." For example, I can give them advice, "Don't get involved in wandering thoughts," or "Drop your thoughts," or "Stop trying to get into a blissful state." Yet during interview, some students will ask, "How can I return to a blissful state? My practice was going so well." We don't have that here though. Even though they have heard me say not to get involved in different states, they just keep going with their method. As soon as they get into some pleasant state, they forget what I said. The fourth type is the student who needs a good beating, metaphorically speaking. This type of student must be told the same thing again and again and again, either because they don't retain it or because they hold on to their own ideas so strongly that hardly anything gets through. We don't have any students here like that either.
No.
So it's very difficult to guide them. Dr. Jimmy Yu, who is the founder of the Tallahassee Zen Center, added another type of horse that I like. According to him, the fifth type of horse simply stands there even if you beat it. It's called beating a dead horse. These students are so ingrained in their views and opinions about things and words and language and in their own constructive views that they can't break free, nor do they really want to. Whatever you teach them, or no matter how hard you try, they just won't move. We don't have them here either, okay. There's a Chinese expression that says, don't play music to a cow. This means that no matter what you play, whether a Beethoven piano sonata or John Coltrane's Love Supreme, the cow simply can't appreciate it. It just keeps chewing on the grass while you're playing a sophisticated tune. There are students like that. The mind of the teacher and the student just don't meet. Now, sometimes we are one type of horse, at other times we're another. It's about timing, cause, and conditions. Therefore, it happens that people begin as one type of horse and later end up as another. In this koan, the non-Buddhist was the first type of horse. No practice was necessary. Mumin's commentary is about us. He is asking, what kind of horse are we? When we come across a teaching, how do we respond to the teacher? Isn't it true that sometimes non-Buddhists behave in ways that are even more spiritually mature than Buddhists? Mumin asks us to compare ourselves with the best of non-Buddhists. How far apart is our understanding from theirs? Master Mumin gives a poetic four-line verse as a hint on how to practice genuinely. He walks along the edge of a sword or runs over the sharp ridges of an ice floe. You need take no steps. Let go your hold on the cliff. So Mumin here is suggesting a path to death, not the literal kind, but putting to death self-grasping. And in Zen, there's a saying that you guys are probably familiar with. Only through the great death will you come to great life. The question for us is, are we willing to let go? Practice is unlike anything the world can offer. The world offers craving and bondage. The Dharma offers relinquishment and freedom. The path of relinquishment is like walking on a sword's edge and running on an icy hill. It's dangerous because it can quickly turn to self-aggrandizement or selfish fantasy. I was saying something to someone earlier today about practice. And essentially what I was saying is that at times practice may seem futile, going nowhere. But that's precisely where we are frustrating our self-attachment. So what do? We keep going. Zen Master Dao, who likens the process of koan practice to a dog chewing a tasteless bone. Should the dog stop? No. When the practitioner gets to the stage where it seems like it's going nowhere, it actually is going somewhere. You see, if our practice is such that everything is going routinely without obstacles, then we're probably doing exactly what our self-attachment wants us to do. We need to remember that practice is unlike worldly goal-oriented gains. It's the process that matters. So let me share a couple of analogies with you. When you try to climb a hill of ice, you will eventually slide back. The point is in putting in the effort to get to the top. It's not about getting to the top. In the process of trying, you lose yourself and drop your attachments. Then you realize that you are already on top of the iceberg. When walking on a sword's edge, you will find that there is no one to kill. There is no one who dies. Go up a ladder by putting it down. Now, these analogies may seem nihilistic, but through the ages, the masters have said something to the effect that when you let go, everything comes to life. All things are awakened as they are manifesting in themselves, naturally, without any coloration. Only you, only we are absent. Does the world disappear? No, everything becomes positively clear, as opposed to being limited and skewed by our views and ideas. Zen asks us to put down our colored lens that skew our vision. Awakening is putting down our views. And this is difficult because we love our lens so much. We bring into our views our fantasies and our preferences and our experiences that derive from them. And if I've said this once, I've said it 100 times. In truth, we are scared to let go. Here's the paradox. A lot of people practice so that their life is enriched. They don't want to let go, but they really want to be awakened. They want to have the best of both worlds. We need to see this situation for what it is. Greed, the very culprit that causes us pain. Our whole world is oriented to having, and when we don't have, we feel sad. We feel that we have failed. And this is the nature of samsara. As one teacher put it, we are like a puppet with our emotions going up and down, tied to the strings of having and not having. Having and not having is deeply tied to words. Words and language are structured around binary poles. Having, not having, good, bad, yes, no, these belong to the discriminating mind, which is characterized by pain and self-grasping. How many times have we been told that if we want to enter the gateless barrier, we have to let go. We have to let go, let everything go. When the mind is free from scattered thoughts with it, the coarse states of discriminating mind, we reach a unified state where discrimination based on words and language is transcended. This is not to say words and language are not necessarily useless. They can help us, but when we are caught by them, we suffer. And the point I'm making, which probably is obvious, is that the discriminating mind is intrinsically limited. For example, when I say, I'm this type of person, what prevents me from being that type of person? Words and ideas shape idealistic self-image, and they limit our potential. Following words and concepts, we make ourselves into this or that. The more we grasp them, the more we become bound by them. You may think that Zen prefers silence over words. And in a certain sense, this is true. But the wordless teaching itself can become a source of attachment. Grasping on the silence is like grasping onto non-existence, or not having, or nihilism. What is the teaching that is beyond words and wordlessness, beyond permanence and nihilism, gain and loss, having and lack? The Buddha responded with silence. But that is his answer. What is yours? If you can speak without using words or silence, without mimicking someone else, then you are the first type of horse. If you cannot, whip yourself to get on with practice.